Good afternoon, everyone. We are in Exodus 34th chapter.
The Lord said to Moshe, "Cut for yourself two tablets of stone like the first, and I will write on the tablets the words that were on the first tablets, which you broke. Be ready by the morning, and come up to in the morning to Mount Sinai, and present yourself there to me on top of the mountain. No one shall come up with you, and let no one be seen throughout all the mountain. Let no flocks or herds graze opposite the mountain." So Moshe cut two tablets of stone like the first, and he rose early in the morning and went up on Mount Sinai as the Lord had commanded him, and took in his hand two tablets of stone. The Lord descended in the cloud and stood with him there and proclaimed the name of the Lord. The Lord passed before him and proclaimed, "The Lord, the Lord, a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, keeping steadfast love for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, but who will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children and the children's children to the third and fourth generation." And Moshe quickly bowed his head toward the earth and worshipped. And he said, "If now I have found favor in your sight, O Lord, please let the Lord go in the midst of us, for it is a stiff-necked people, and pardon our iniquity and our sin, and take us for your inheritance." And he said, "Behold, I am making a covenant. Before all your people I will do marvels, such as have not been created in all the earth or in any nation. And all the people among you who are and all the people among you who are shall see the work of the Lord, for it is an awesome thing that I will do with you. Observe what I command for you this day. Behold, I will drive out before you the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. Take care lest you make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land to which you go, lest it become a snare in your midst. You shall tear down their altars and break their pillars and cut down their Asherim. For you shall worship no other god, for the Lord, whose name is Jealous, is a jealous God. Lest you make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land, and when they whore after gods and sacrifice to their gods, and you are invited, you eat of the sacrifice, and you take of their daughters for your sons, and their daughters whore after their gods, and make your sons whore after their gods. You shall not make for yourself any gods of cast metal. You shall keep the feast of unleavened bread. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread, as I commanded you, at the time appointed for you in the month of Abib, for in the month of Abib you came out of Egypt. All that open the womb are mine, all your male livestock, the firstborn of cow and sheep, the firstborn of a donkey, you shall redeem it with a lamb. Or, if you will not redeem it, you shall break its neck. All the firstborn of your sons you shall redeem, and none shall appear before me empty-handed. 6 days you shall work, but the seventh day you shall rest. In plowing time and in harvest you shall rest. You shall observe the Feast of Weeks, the first fruits of wheat harvest, and the Feast of Ungathering in the year's end. 3 times a year shall all your males appear before the Lord God, the God of Israel. For I will cast out nations before you and enlarge your borders. No one shall covet your land when you go up to appear before the Lord your God 3 times in the year. You shall not offer the blood of my sacrifice with anything leavened, or let the sacrifice of the feast of the Passover remain until morning. The best of the first fruits of your ground you shall bring to the house of the Lord your God. You shall not boil a young goat in its mother's milk. And the Lord God said to Moses, "Write these words, for in accordance with these words I have made a covenant with you and with Israel." So he was there with the Lord 40 days and 40 nights. He neither ate bread nor drank water, and he wrote on the tablets the words of the covenant, the Ten Commandments. When Moshe came down from Mount Sinai, and with the two tablets of the testimony in his hand as he came down from the mountain, Moshe did not know that the skin of his face shone, because he had been talking with God. Aharon and all the people of Israel saw Moshe, and behold, the skin of his face shone, and they were afraid to come near him. But Moshe called to them, and Aharon and all the elders of the congregation returned to him, and Moshe talked with them. Afterward, all the people of Israel came near, and he commanded them all that the Lord had spoken to him on Mount Sinai. And when Moshe had finished speaking with them, he put a veil over his face. Whenever Moshe went in before the Lord to speak with him, he would remove the veil until he came out. And when he came out and told the people of Israel what the Lord, what he was commanded, the people of Israel would see the face of Moshe, that the skin of Moshe's face was shining. And Moshe would put the veil over his face again until he went in to speak with him.
How could he live 40 days on the mountain with no water?
He must have lost a lot of weight. Any other comments? Oh, there you go.
Yeah, verse 24 is very fascinating to me. It says, for I will drive, you know, for the first part of it, it says, I'll drive the nations out before you and enlarge your borders. But the second part is what fascinates me, because it says, and no man shall covet your land when you go three times a year to appear before the Lord your God. So imagine if you're a family living on a border town somewhere, the man might be tempted to stay home because he lives in a border town and he might be vulnerable to enemies. But it says here that if they will obey his rules, he will not only drive out the nations from the land, but he will protect those border areas so that they can safely go and not have to worry about what might go on at home.
There was a time some years ago, just give you a hint, that Ellie and I went to the feast in Tahoe some years ago. And we left our front door wide open. No one entered in to take anything. And so we are kind of like, say, living witnesses. Yeah, it was protected because God let everybody think doors closed. I don't know how. But nonetheless, it's quite a famous, kind of interesting. But I do believe that. I mean, it just, we were quite surprised that, and we looked, drove in. We left the door wide open. Okay, we went in. Okay, is anything all there? Yeah, everything's there. So I do think that's quite a promise that is very, very upright with God. I mean, his word is true. Any other thoughts, any other statements that came in this book?
Why no animals? He said no animals could graze on the mountain while they were there, and no man, let no man appear, but no animals, like an animal couldn't even accidentally wander on there. What? Why was that?
Holy ground. Yeah, the whole mountain was holy ground. It's quite fascinating. He didn't mean like, you know, a wild animal, they can't stop them. But he means of the cattle, of the sheep, especially goats. They like to climb mountains. They love climbing mountains. And so they had to keep them off from down there. Yeah. It was because something was going to happen on this second adventure. Remember the first time, someone else went up there with him. Do you remember who it was? Joshua. This time, just Moses and Moses only. Okay? So what does that kind of tell you? Go ahead.
Well, I'm not to respond to that, but verse 12, it says, take heed to yourself, lest you make a covenant with them and inhabitants of the land, that it, lest it be a snare to you. I think that's pretty cool because he mentions that three other times here, just in Deuteronomy, in 20:18, 12:30, and 7:16. It's for our protection that we don't fall in that snare and that trap. We have a great Abba.
I guess you can look at it that way. That's not bad. I have a little different viewpoint on it, but okay. Verse 1. The first thing we have here, you know, I've read some commentaries and everything else, like most of you have. And it looks like when the last part of that sentence, the tablets which you, Moses, broke. It's like he was upset with Moses. But you keep on reading this particular chapter, it doesn't seem like he was upset with Moses at all for breaking the tablets. Now, why would he break the tablets? What was the symbolism of breaking the tablets? I'm sorry, what?
Broken covenant.
Broken covenant. So it's a picture of of Israel breaking what they just got to saying 40 days earlier that they would do. And now it says they put, this particular chapter has a statement in it, which we'll go through toward the end of it, but it's very close to what the Ten Commandments, one of the Ten Commandments is. We'll go back and look at that for a minute when we get there. Now, see, he broke them, yes. Who was hot under the collar? Moses was hot under the collar, right? Now, as we read last time, well, maybe it's this time, he said, I don't know who you are. Remember? He said, God, I don't know who you are. I don't know what you think. I don't know what's in your mind. And you say you have favor with me, but here you're going to leave. How can you leave? And he says, these are your people. Remember the argument going back, your people, my people, your people, my people? Over the term of stiff-necked. You remember that? When the people were stiff-necked, they were Moses' people. And Moses turned around and said, yes, they are stiff-necked. But don't forget, these are your people. And that's not that God was passing the buck. It's just like saying, you know, the group you're with is just, they're stiff-necked. They're not going to do anything I want them to do. And that's probably a real legitimate answer and response. And so we go in here, and he goes down now. And he said, now I want you, verse 2, be ready in the morning and come up in the morning to Mount Sinai and present yourselves to me there on the top of the mountain. So now he's going to go back up to the top of the mountain where he once was before. Actually, he wasn't there before. Now he's on top of the mountain. You know, who was on top of the mountain first? All right, because Moses is down at the bottom now. You listen to the Ten Commandments. And there's fire and smoke and all that heavy stuff coming down and earthquake, you know, that even made Moses quake. Now he goes to the top of the mountain, goes up there. But he says, now you're the only one that's going to come up. He says, no one else is going to come up at this mountain whatsoever. Neither are you the flock or the herd, neither the sheep nor the goats are going to keep them back. Don't let them touch and feed upon this mountain. It kind of tells you it must have been some kind of grass up there for them to eat. Not necessarily people could eat grass, but they could eat grass. And that's interesting in verse 3. Stop and think about there. Who was present as a second witness that Moses went there? What? They weren't there, yes?
Was it the Ten Tablets, the commandments?
They weren't written on yet. They were broken. He's taken up two tablets and not written on yet. We have this concept. What? You have to have two witnesses, right? So, here he is. Moses go up there. No one else. How do you know he went up there? Can you prove it? Where's the second witness?
Huh?
I'm sorry, what?
Some people followed him, but they didn't go all the way.
They didn't go all the time. They didn't go at all. Don't even come. What? What?
God.
Oh, yeah, that's a good witness, don't you think? Because the people knew there was a being up there who was going to come back down in a dark cloud. Right? As we read this chapter, he didn't come down in shining light with a halo around his head. He came down in a dark cloud. Every time he says he comes in a cloud, it's always a dark one. When he went into the temple during Solomon's time, it was a dark cloud. You couldn't see anything in it. It was dark. Can't see past that darkness. And so there's a reason why God hides himself in darkness. What? He's the light, isn't he? No, he hides himself in darkness. Why does he hide himself in darkness for? Well, we'll see in this particular chapter, it's so bright you could be blinded by his presence. And Moses got to see what part of him? the backside, and it was blinding him, if I put it this way. I actually wanted to blind the people, in a sense. It was so bright and terrifying. Actually, what it says is shining. It's like not the sun itself, but the rays of the sun that's so bright. Every time they use it bright as a sun, it's not really the sun itself, but it's like the rays of the sun are so bright that it's hard to see. You don't have to look at the sun, but you look outside sometimes, the sun is real, real bright, especially on a snowy ground is real, real bright. Yes?
Even Moses' face was too bright for the people to look at. Right.
Yeah. Now, this is very fascinating what this incident is all about, because it's going to lead us to someplace else, God willing. And then verse 5 is where he says, he stood in the cloud and stood with him. There it is. There's Yahweh standing there with Moses, all right? But he's in a cloud and Moses is not. Right? That's what it says. So it's pretty obvious he's doing this for a reason. There's something that's very interesting about God. He sends to work in the dark first. He sits and works in the dark first. Then he brings forth what he's doing in daytime. I mean, just take a look at Genesis chapter 1. Verse 2 tells you his spirit moved upon the Tohu Vahoshef on darkness, blackness, no light. And when his spirit moved upon it, then he said, let there be light. And that's what he was presenting to the entire world. This is light. Because in our world, you and I, we should be coming into the light and become lights, even though others may see us as Hoshek, darkness. Let's go on. And he said, now this is very interesting, and Yahweh, verse 6 says, passed before him and proclaimed, Yahweh, Yahweh, Elohim. Now it's like, he's in a cloud now. Can't be seen, just a cloud. And then the first thing he says, Yahweh, I'm Yahweh, Elohim. It's like if you were meeting somebody and you were in a different room, and they were over there, and you're coming to meet them, and you brought out, leave my name. Hi, I'm Richard Agee. And they say, oh, yeah, okay. And now you know who he is. This is what the statement's all about. Now listen very carefully what he says, though. Before he sees anything, this is what he says. Merciful and gracious. The first thing he identifies himself, remember Moses says, I don't know who you are. I don't know what you think. I don't understand what this is all about. Now you remember, Moses is called at the age of 80. This is about a year later. And there he is. 80 years old, remember he's terrified? And so this is not like he's 40, 50, 60, 120 years later. This is within a year or two of him says, I don't know who you are. I don't know what you think. I don't know your accent. I don't understand your accent. I don't understand what you said. You said you like me and you have favor with me, but I don't know anything about you. Now here, the first thing that God introduces himself is, I am merciful and gracious. I'm long-suffering and abounding in goodness and truth. And I am keeping mercy or kindness for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgressions and sin. That's a pretty big statement, don't you think? Now, Moses gets to hear this part. The first thing God introduced himself to Moses is this. Now, Moses gets, okay, that's who you are. Okay. Got that. Now the next statement is very puzzling. It seems very puzzling. And I have to kind of understand, help you look up. There's an other side of God here. This side is abundant. The other side says something different. However, no means am I going to clear the guilty. He didn't say, I'm not going to clear the sinners, the transgressions, iniquities. I am not going to let them off. Visiting the iniquity to the fathers, of to the children, to third and fourth, and to the third and fourth generation. What does that mean?
The grandchildren.
The issue is iniquity. If the father is doing iniquity, and the son follows the father's pattern of doing iniquity, and the grandson follows the grandfather's and doing iniquity, and up to the fourth generation, guess what happens? It's over with. Wipes out. Does God wipe out a whole generation? Always. Every word of God, when it is transgressed against him, and their iniquity, they're doing something so vile that God says, I'm finished you, and you're up to the fourth generation. It's not going to continue after the fourth. It's over with. Yes.
Could you give a definition of iniquity versus like just sin? I mean, there's these different categories of...
Sin is missing the mark or making mistakes. Yes. Falling on your face because you did something stupid. Transgression is real simple. Breaking the law itself. Breaking the commandment itself. That's transgression. That's the book of... John said that transgression, sin is a transgression of the Torah, or sin is a transgression of the law. Then what is iniquity?
Nimrod.
Okay, go ahead.
I don't understand. By no means leaving unpunished, visiting the crookedness of the fathers upon the children and the children's children to the third and fourth generation.
Correct.
Does that mean he will never forgive people when they come to him?
No, he'll wipe out them out. He did it with Korah, and he did it with Dathan in the book of Numbers. Wiped them out. No more of the kids. They're gone. The sins, bye. It doesn't repeat itself. It comes to a stop. God will stop iniquity in a group of people who continue on up to the third and fourth generation. It will not go to the fifth.
So these are unrepentant people. Huh? That don't want to really follow.
Unto the father who does iniquity, and his son who does it, follows his father's pathway and does iniquity, and his grandson does iniquity, he's going to stop it.
Okay, so if my father did awful iniquity, then I can be punished for his iniquity?
If you follow through and do exactly what your father did in iniquity, yeah.
Okay. Okay.
But he says, I'll show a thousand, the commandments, I'll show a thousand of mercy to those who love me. Any one of those family members, the father who's done iniquity, the son doesn't have to follow suit. Book of, what's that, Ezekiel? Yeah. About the three generations right there.
Okay.
All right. He will show mercy and kindness to those who stop in that line. But if you keep going, now how many people are you aware of in your world of history, where the father does something, the son does the same thing, the next son does the same thing. Look at the kings. Especially of Israel. Wiped them out.
They still haven't defined iniquity. Iniquity is willful disobedience.
Deliberate. Well,
and willful disobedience.
Let's put it in a different word. This will cover it. This Jack will cover it out too. But let's go for a moment to Exodus 20th chapter.
I'm sorry.
No. It's a legitimate question. I've repeated myself several times, and that's okay. What do you think iniquity is? It sure isn't a pleasant thing, is it? It is deliberately going against. It's like deliberately breaking the law. Deliberately doing in defiance. Not when you transgress the law, but when you're deliberately doing in defiance of. Listen carefully what the Ten Commandments has to say about it. It has to do with a very special thing, which is also recorded in the 34th chapter of Exodus. Same phrase, same terminology. Verse 20th chapter. Verse 4. You shall not make for yourself any graven image or any kind likeness of anything that is in heaven above, including himself, or that it's in the waters, or under the earth. You shall not bow yourself down to them, nor shall you serve them, for I, your Elohim, your God, is a jealous God. It should be zealous. Is actually Hebrew is zealous, angry, mad, furious. Visiting the iniquities of the father, the children of the third and fourth generation, why is he going to visit them for? What are they doing? They're making an image of Elohim. They're making an image. And he says, you keep that going, you're out.
So if I have a picture of Jesus in my house, which I do not, I should follow him into my mother's house.
You have to make your own judgment upon what you think it is, what he's thinking of. I'm not going to judge anybody. I'm not going to tell you what you should or should not do. Just read what it says. Accept what it says, and that's the end of the statement. Okay, I'm never going to tell any of you what you should or should not do. I'm only telling you what the Word of God says. I am going to visit you if you people, you as an individual, you Father, if you create an image of me in any likeness whatsoever, whether it's in heaven or on earth or under the earth, I am not going to. You hate me. You despise me. Therefore, I'm going to wipe you out. And he's done that time and time again in the book of, and in the history of Israel. Yes.
Yesterday, I had a lady tell me that she was becoming Jewish. She was, what do you call that?
Converting
to Judaism. And she had been a Christian, I guess, knew about Christianity. But what she said was the reason she... that you can't make an image of God. And so this is what they're using as an excuse to say that Yeshua isn't valid because it's an image of God in the flesh. This is interesting that you're bringing this up because this is what she said to me yesterday. So.
Yeah, and the next part of this commandment is, but showing mercy... What does it say in the 34th chapter there? Merciful and gracious. Why? Because he says, these are the ones I will give mercy to. These are the ones I will be gracious to. These are the ones my long suffering will be with. These are the ones that I will tell the truth. But I'm not going to tell the truth to those who make an image. Both this chapter, 20th chapter, 34th chapter, don't make an image. Very strong. The 34th chapter will reach this. Yes.
Regarding the comment that was just made, my perception is that we didn't make the image of Christ in his person. God made that image. And so
Anyway.
Yeah, so basically what you're saying here is basically what God is saying to Moses, because Moses has been previously praying to God,
right.
You know, forgive them, put their sin on me, this kind of thing. And so God is just basically saying to him, by repeating this particular commandment that the children of Israel had broken with the golden calf.
Yes.
He's basically kind of reiterating, like, you know, I can have lots of mercy, but I also have to have some justice here, too.
Yes.
On the third and fourth generation, they're going to have to see some justice.
Yeah, justice.
And I just think of it in terms of, he has to maintain his perfect balance of mercy and justice, because if he lets iniquity go on, then what does that say to the righteous that he's allowing that to go on?
He's showing mercy and gracious to the ones who worship another God or ones who are transgressing against him by doing just the opposite.
Yeah, he can only let that go so far, you know, until he has to respond to it.
We as parents can't give reward to a child who's deliberately doing something gross. We don't say, oh, I love you anyway, and give them a reward. No, you really get upset with them. Don't think God does the same thing? Yes.
Well, kind of in line with what Tammy was saying, you can't technically have mercy unless justice has already been established. It's dependent on it. And if you're going to just stop with the justice and continue on the train of mercy, eventually you're putting mercy on an iniquitous group of people, which is not mercy to any righteous people who are being affected anymore.
Correct.
So you have to have the justice.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
So what's the difference between mercy and long-suffering?
Oh, what is the difference between mercy and long-suffering? Good question. What is mercy and what is long-suffering? Time, a lot of time. Does God suffer?
Yes.
Yes. Does he suffer for how long? How long? Unlike a God that wants to destroy, this one is showing long-suffering. Who's showing long-suffering to? He's just showing long-suffering to those who deliberately make an image and have transgressed him and hate him? No, he doesn't show any long-suffering whatsoever to them. He gives long-suffering to those that do what? And hear him. Want to respond to him. Every one of you in this room, you have long, God has given you long-suffering.
Amen.
There is, no one could escape from it and say, well, I don't, I responded quickly. No, no. He endured, remember the Apostle Paul says, while you and I were at war with God, he did what? Long suffering. Who suffered? Who suffered? Now, sometimes we don't think that the Father ever suffers anything. He suffered the loss of his Son. Is that a big loss? A big one. So, yes. Now, also, this tells you something a little bit different about God. The second time he went to the mountain. What is it telling you?
God's second chance.
Verse 10. Oh, I'm sorry. Did you have something to say?
He suffered the loss of his Son.
Oh.
But because he created us in his image, and his concern for us is like his Son, it is loss when we deliberately keep shooting ourselves in the foot.
Actually,
and crying
the long suffering started with Adam, and it's going to end. All right. We think Adam was a nasty joke. No, no. Adam was created in the image of God. That's what it says. Richard? Yeah, go ahead.
That's actually the response to what Louise was saying earlier about the person, because they were concerned about Yeshua being created in the image of God. Adam was created in the image of God. And it says there in Genesis 1, 26 and 27... that he made male and female in the image of God. He created them.
Yeah.
That was the first image of God. That's why Paul says the first man.
Yes.
And then talks about the second man. That's what that point is. So, you know, if you want to go back and discuss that further, say, you know, God started with that image in the garden, right at the beginning.
Back on that could have been, we don't worship Adam as God, though.
Verse 10.
Moving on.
This is an incredible statement. What do you think he's making? What is he saying here? He's already made a covenant. Right? Now he says, I'm going to make a covenant. Oh, wait a minute. What kind of covenant are you going to make? Who does it involve? What's it about? The second time he went to that mountain, the first time was the first covenant. The second time he's going to introduce another covenant. Listen, I'm going to make a covenant. With whom? Before all your people, Moses. I will do marvelous things such have not been done in all of the earth. What did he do? Or what is going to, what does he make his covenant? He's going to do something that is more marvelous than anything else that he's ever done. Listen carefully. And no other nation, all peoples among whom you, Moses, are shall see the works of Yahuwah. What is the works?
That is such a covenant that is so marvelous, so awesome, so big. And yet, what is it? So Moses, this is a very important part. Something happened to Moses when all this took place. All right? For it is an awesome thing that I'll do with you. Awesome. What's awesome? Now, this is bigger than the first one. It's more marvelous than the first one. It's more overwhelming than the first one. Do you get an indication here that Moses understood something? Or was told something that the people didn't understand? Or maybe even those who read now, we'll get to Moses in a minute. Apostle Paul, rather, in a minute. And it's a very amazing thing. He's going to do a work. Now, in Philippians, if I'm not mistaken, he says something to Philippians. He says, God is going to work out his work, good works in you. Now, that is an awesome thing. Okay? When God works his work in you, we're not talking about some idiot. We're talking about the creator of heaven and earth, who is working in us to bring about what his will is. And are we willing to go there? Are we willing to let him work it out? Sometimes it's hard because the Messiah said, this work or way is difficult. It is narrow, very narrow, and few go this way. All right? Those are big words, aren't they? Now, is that more awesome? Well, we look at the world and we say, God, you haven't done your job. Yes?
You know, I find it interesting. But causing the negative effects of the parents' offenses to be experienced by their children and grandchildren. Oops, sorry. is that kind of it's a way of looking at ourselves after the fact, and a way of making us be humble, creating humility in us, because, I mean, we're like devastated that our children are doing the things we did in our youth, you know? I mean, we were like young and
We're talking what you and I would look at that point of view. But that, the one about inequities, is something different. Like he's teaching his son deliberately to do what I am doing, or you're kicked out of the family. I don't know what the charge is. What they do. They're just a nasty thing. We're not talking about ordinary guys. Let's talk maybe mafia. After you kill, kill again, kill again. And the third and fourth generation, kill, kill, kill. You know, murder, rob, steal, whatever it takes. Yes.
About what you just said about to walk with Christ is difficult. There's the quote where he says, my yoke is easy and my burden is light. And a friend of mine who's a Greek scholar said that word easy, according to his understanding, actually means kindness. And so that agrees with what you're saying. Like, relative to the other way,
okay.
Walking with him is kindness.
I looked at that. That's probably very true. Yes. That sounds logical. That would make sense.
Right? But it's not easy.
No.
It's interpreted as easy.
It's a whole lot easier to take, a whole lot easier to deal with, because he's kind. Yes?
When you know the truth, the real truth, you can't get away from it.
You can try, but it ain't going to work. No. You can say, well, the devil made me do it. No, God says it's you. We live in a world where everybody else is doing it wrong, and the devil made me do it, and all that kind of stuff. It's the quote, Republicans made me do it. No, Democrats made me do it. No, Independents made me do it. No, you did it, politically speaking. All right? Yes?
This is kind of funny, but Bob Dylan says, all the truth in the world only adds up to one big lie, and it's really, that's true.
Bob Dylan, I haven't heard that name in years. Anyway, and so he goes on. We go on to observe the commandments I've told you and make sure you worship
and tell him that you worship Elohim, your God, whose name is Zealous and is a zealous Elohim, verse 14. Let's move on here. He talks about sacrifices and those things, the unleavened bread, days of unleavened bread, and very interesting here about the section here about the first. Let's move on here real quickly because I'm running out of time almost here. And let's see, firstborn. Let's go down to... Now, verse 21, that's interesting. He said, now 6 days you shall do your work, and the seventh day you shall rest. He clarifies it even more. You're not going to plow, nor are you going to sow. You're going to not do it. Earlier in the previous chapter, when he was building the temple, or building the tabernacle, he said, you will not work on my dwelling place on the Sabbath. Mean this for God! Don't work on the Sabbath to build my dwelling place. But I'm working for you, like, don't build my dwelling place on the Sabbath. So it's a big issue with God, don't you think? Pay a little closer attention to that. So I finally found it here. He even clarified it about when we take commandments talking about the don't let somebody work that works for you, don't let them work. And so on and so forth. And he said, you observe the Feast of Weeks, the first fruits of the wheat harvest. That's the first of the first, or the Rosh sheet of the harvest. Now, the Rosh sheet is the beginning. And he says this in verse 25, is it? Or let me get back here again. Verse 26. And it says there, the first of the first fruit. In Hebrew, it means the Rosh sheet of the first fruits. That has to do with days, the seventh day, or 7 days of, Shavuot, the 7 weeks. And there's a period of time during days of unleavened bread. There is a, it's called the first, the Rosh sheet of the harvest. That's what you take to God. Then you can continue on. And he says, you will observe it and you shall do it. Okay. And so he's up there for 40 days and 40 nights. Then he comes down. Verse 29. You know, come down from Mount Sinai and the two tablets of testimony were Moses' hand. And his face, something was funny with his face. He didn't know it. But he saw the glory of the backside. What it would look like if he saw the front side. But he wouldn't be, because he said, you're not gonna live if you see the front side of my side, Moses, and I'm not gonna kill you after that. And his skin on his face shined real bright. And in verse 34, and Moses called them, that is Aaron and all the elders, the leadership, not the people, called the elders leadership. And there was only the leadership and the that went to see Moses, talk with Moses, and they transferred that information onto their people, one tribe at a time, one section at a time. And so what, not everybody heard everything all at the same time. What is, tell Moses, tell Aaron and all the rulers, okay, of the congregation. And then afterwards, and when Moses had finished speaking with them, he put a veil on his face. Very fascinating terminology, don't you think? Why a veil?
Because Moses only had like a small portion of God's glory on him, so to speak, but he covered that glory when he was not speaking God's words to the people.
Yeah, when he went to point, when once he talked to done, God, he lifted it up and he read dog and put it back in, and when he went out of his tent.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, or the tent of the meeting place. Now, when we look at this thing, yes, yes.
I also find it kind of humorous in a way that God didn't warn him. Because, like, if you saw something on someone's face, like, let's say they had some food on their face or something like that, it would be a kindness to them to point it out, you got some spinach between your teeth or something like that. But God doesn't warn him. Oh, by the way, Moses, there's nothing you might need to know when you go back down. God doesn't say anything to him about that, and so I just find it kind of humorous, you know. That's me.
Oh, can I start over here? Oops, go ahead.
But I truly believe that was to be a testament to the people.
Okay.
I always saw Daniel? That as that.
Wait, she had a question over here, too. He had a question over here. Somebody did.
The imagery that's given is that normally when somebody needs to go talk to God, they go to the tabernacle meeting. Well, Moses is the one who would go. The people themselves didn't usually go inside. It was Moses who went inside, which is almost like behind a veil, so to speak, to talk to God. So that same imagery, since Moses was supposed to be like God in many ways, he comes out, well, God among you, well, you still have a veil over God so you don't get yourself either
so
killed or lost.
So he's hiding something.
That's what hiding something is, that he's trying to bring the imagery.
He's covering something up.
He's trying to bring the imagery that only the high priest normally gets to see. He brings that imagery out to the people themselves. They recognize what the high priest sees. The high priest sees a veil that covers between the Ark of the Covenant and everybody else. Well, Moses is supposed to be a representation of that. So, and God said he wants to dwell with the people, among the people. Well, it's a symbolic version of what God's trying to explain to them.
Well, it's not too hard to understand, right? All right. That's kind of self-evident that when Moses is up there for another 40 days, not everything that God told him is written. Did you notice that? The first time, great details, including the book of Leviticus, was written on the first time, and all the things they had to do wasn't up there the first time, not the second time. And the tabernacle and the description of how it would be done in preciseness was done on the first time, but not the second time. So what was Moses to see, if I can use that terminology, actually I use it for sure. What was Moses to hear in order for him to see? What did he hear in order that he may see? What did he hear? Not much is read there, right? Not much is written there. Real short chapter. The second time, real short. He came back down again, it looks like. Oh, he was up there a couple days. He was up there for 40 days. All right. Now, this is where I'm going to intervene here. I use this terminology. I want you to go to 2 Chronicles, New Testament. New Testament. 2 Corinthians, I'm sorry. Corinthians. I'm still in the other world, you know. Corinthians. 2 Corinthians. And chapter 3. This is where the Apostle Paul talks about the veil. And what it was all about. Why? It was that way. And the purpose thereof. Sometimes it's hard to understand the Apostle Paul's writings. It's hard to figure out just what is he saying here. And almost like he's saying, whatever was said in the old is of no value. We have to be careful who he's talking to and why he's talking to them. He's not talking to the 21st century human beings. He's talking to the, quote, first century of the human beings. And in a Gentile congregation, he's explaining to them things they have heard, things they've been taught, and things they have either understood or didn't understand. Because the plague that was happening, if I could call it a plague, you remember that some of the Jewish teachers were teaching that you must have circumcision before you can be saved. You must have do this, do that, do this, do that before you can be considered salved, saved by God. Even though the Gentiles didn't have that. They were saved without that. Or salvation was given to them without that. So now we're here, and let's start in verse 1. I think I could finish before 3 o'clock. Well, others do, because they're here to speak also. Okay. Do we begin again to command ourselves, or do we need, as some epistles, of accommodations to you, or to accommodation from you? Do I need that stuff, Apostle Paul says? Do we need that stuff? Do you need that stuff from us? Do I have to send you a bunch of papers? Do I send you accommodations? Here I am, ordained here, a signature of all the James and all the Peter and everybody else. No. He didn't have to do that. He continues on. You are our written epistle. Where is it written at? So they know something. They were told and they believed and they trusted what was told to them. Where is it written? In their heart. Very big. And it continues on. Okay. Known and read by all. Wow. It's self-evidence. Look, everybody looks around and know that what this is all about. You don't need an epistle from me, and I don't need accommodations from you. You are the evidence. You are the living evidence of what this message is all about. He talks about two things here. Clearly, an epistle from the Messiah, does he get that? Ministered by us. Epistle from whom? Oh, wasn't he dead and buried and gone? Epistle from the Messiah, written not with ink, but with the Spirit of the living Elohim. Oh, that's fascinating. The Spirit of God, the Father himself, has written in our hearts. What did he write? What did he write? This is what we have to pay attention to, because this chapter will tell you exactly what he wrote. And the veil comes into play in this chapter. All right? Verse 6. Who made us, we talk about Paul himself, all the apostles, to be ministers or servants of what? Of what? The new covenant, the new testament. Okay, we just got the reading there in the 34th chapter of Exodus that he's going to make a new covenant, a different covenant that is more awesome. This covenant that God has given to us by in that covenant, and it's the Messiah himself who wrote the covenant. It's the Messiah himself who wrote it. No one else did. Yes.
What you're saying and what the Apostle Paul is saying is that the first record of the new covenant isn't in Jeremiah 31, it's in Exodus 34.
Yes. All right. That's what I'm saying. You can disagree. That's fine. No. That's how I look at these things. I see things that God had planned long, long, thousands of years ago. Okay? Let's go on. And he says, the new covenant, not of the letter, but of the Spirit. What's the difference? The letter kills. What does the Spirit do? Gives life. So, the Messiah, Yeshua, has written in our hearts and in these people's hearts during the first century, what did he write? The Spirit of the living God. Wow. Now, let's continue on. I'm getting running out of time here.
But he says, now let's continue on. He said, but the Spirit does not kill. What does the Spirit do?
Life.
Gives life. That's what Moses understood the second time he was up there. What did he say? Merciful and gracious, right? Long suffering. What was it? Enduring. A gathering. I can't remember. I've got to go back and read it. But also truth. All of that's there. Now, when you use those words, you start thinking, okay, what the Messiah says, I am the way, I am the life, I am the truth. I'm the resurrection. I give life. I'm the one that's giving life. From what? From what the other covenant was going to take away. The other covenant couldn't give life. The other covenant can only give death. It could not restore anybody from the dead. This one has power over. This covenant has the power over the covenant of death. How do we know this? I hold what's written within your heart. The Spirit of the living God. God is life. Life is God. God is Spirit. Spirit is God. Everything that's life comes from Him. Everything that's dead doesn't come from Him. Yes.
So what we're dealing with is not two covenants in time, but two covenants in quality and initiator. Meaning one covenant is of the letter, I do it. The other one is of the Spirit. Spirit does it by changing you.
Yes.
So that's one of those things about new versus old.
Yes. That's the terminology. Why say old? Why say new? Because the new one does something different. The old has no more burden on you. Listen. Let's drop down here. Got to get down to here. Verse 12. Therefore, since we have such hope, we, Apostle Paul and the other apostles, use great boldness in speech. Unlike Moses. Who had to put a veil over his face so the children of Israel would not see and look constantly. He had to veil it because he was concealing something, covering something up. What was he covering up? And he said, we're not like Moses. We're not doing what Moses had to do. What are we doing? But their minds, verse 14, are blinded. For until this day, the same veil remains unlifted in the reading of the Old Covenant. He's talking about, of course, his people in the first century and how they lived their life. Okay? Not the average Jew, but I didn't care one way or the other. We're talking about someone who is trying to do their best to live according to the Torah and the prophets and all that. But within the Torah tells us something is going to bring about that's different. Yes.
So one of the things of why Moses had to have that veil over his face is because he was there speaking with God and had a relationship with God as a friend.
Uh-huh.
And that is the key to that new covenant versus old covenant. So if you still approach the law of God, not as if you are a friend of God and having that sort of close relationship with God, then you're still in the old covenant sort of thing. I will do it.
Yeah, right. And now we've got verse 14, the latter part of this verse is very interesting. All right? The veil is taken away for us. book of Hebrews talks about a veil. Remember I told you what that word means in Hebrew?
What?
That which must be torn.
The veil means that which must
be torn. A verb, that which will has to be torn. It's put into shreds. And book of Hebrews says, that is the what? The body of the Messiah. Torn to pieces, into shreds. Now, in the book of Hebrews, now we can enter into the Holy of Holies. We can enter into where God is at. You say, well, no, I can't do that. I'm flesh. Listen very carefully to what the Apostle Paul is saying, because it's very important. The Messiah took something away. He took the veil away. What else did the Messiah do? He has written an epistle. And his epistle's not written with ink or a chisel. It's written according to the promise in Jeremiah, written in the heart, your head and in your heart. That's where it's at. So we have this picture of this veil, which Apostle Paul talked about. Verse 16 is, nevertheless, when one turns to the Lord, meaning Yahshua, he's the one that wrote the epistle. He's the one that removed the veil. Moses didn't remove it. Messiah removed it. The Messiah took it away. And when you go to the Lord, meaning the Messiah, Yahshua, the veil is taken away. When that veil is taken away, what do you see? The Lord is Spirit, and He's going to administrate the Spirit of the living God. That's what Yahshua does for a living. He is administrating the Spirit of the living God in us. That's a function of what the high priest does. That's a function of what the Son of God does. He's not out there trying to take our lives. He's in there writing within us. Into our mind and our hearts. He's writing within us the Spirit of the living God. His Father. But we all, with unveiled faces, behold in the mirror, our faces are now unveiled. Verse 18 here. Now you get to see. What are you seeing? What are you looking at? What do you notice? What you should see is what is written. And what is written, you will hear. I often tell people, whenever you hear the Word of God, you will see God. Whenever you hear the word of the Messiah, you will see the Messiah. So what do you see? What do you look at? What are you observing? What kind of God are you serving? Moses asked this question. Who are you? I don't know anything about you. What's going on? You said you will, then you said you won't. Now you said this. You said, what's going on? I don't get the picture. He got the picture. And the veil was the picture. The veil was the picture. That must be removed. It could not be removed during the time of Moses. Because that veil has to have been the Messiah himself. Removing the veil. That the glory, the beauty, the awesomeness of God will be seen and will be known and will be admired. And that is the greatest and most awesome. This is the 34th chapter. It is the most awesome thing that will ever happen. Now, we look at this world today and we say, what's awesome out there? Well, see, if we look at the world, what are you seeing? You're seeing the administration of
death being instituted. You can't do nothing about it because you don't have no control over it. You can't end it. You don't know how to stop it. But who can end it? Who can stop it? Yeah, and through his son, who is the one who took away the veil and writing into you and into me something that's not hidden anymore, something that's revealed to us, something we can understand about God himself, something we can understand about how he thinks, how he acts, how he walks, and all of his things. He says, come and soar like an eagle with me. And he, if you have God's spirit, you're soaring like an eagle. You'll see what he is seeing. You'll understand what he understands. You will understand how his plan, his thought, and how much he adored. He loved the world so much that he killed his only son in order that he can bring many sons into his glory. When I saw that many years ago in the 34th chapter, I said, oh my, this is going right back to Apostle Paul. I got to talk about this one today. And I hope it gives you hope. Hope not that you are lost. Hope that you have such an awesomeness, an awesome God that has called you unto himself. He's going to finish what he started. He will complete it. He doesn't do things half-heartedly. He does it with all his might, all his strength, and I say all his love toward us.